Our guest today is Professor Albi Anand Kurian, a global marketing practitioner and theorist. Dr. Kurian has been featured among 30 marketing people in the world and is currently senior faculty at Exeter University in the UK. With a career graph that encompasses scripting, filmmaking, writing, and teaching marketing at classrooms in IIM and FTII in India, as well as in Singapore and now at Exeter University in the UK, he's truly creating a huge impact in understanding marketing, both from an academic as well as a practitioner's perspective. Welcome to My First Job, where we find out what drives people, how luck plays a role, and the lessons they've learned. This is episode 9, and like every interesting career journey, it's full of twists, turns, and insights. My name is Venugopal Nair. I'm the host of the podcast and CEO of Ideascape Communications, an advertising agency into branding, creative, and design. So settle in, sit back, and enjoy the conversation. Dr. Albi Kurian is currently in Cambridge, and that's where he's speaking to us from.
Good morning, Venu. It's morning out here in Cambridge in the UK, so, and it's freezing cold as well. So I'm glad to be able to even talk to somebody who's in a warmer climate.
Sometimes you wish you could parcel some of the heat and dust of Chennai, or at least the heat of Chennai, to warm the colder areas.
Absolutely. Okay. UK is going through a particularly cold climate in. And it's going through some rather rough times as well, but we'll weather it, I'm sure.
Okay. So what is your new assignment at Exeter University going to be about?
I'll be joining Exeter on the 1st of March. So I will be relocating to this town as well. And sometimes I think that I've got used to relocating. Somebody asked me, where's home? And I said, I was born in Calcutta, but I'm a Keralite. Then I schooled in Bombay. Then I worked in Bombay nearly very, very long time. Then, of course, I went to New York. Then I went to Singapore. I taught all over the world. I know China very well. And now I'm here in the UK. And only because for some personal reasons, I couldn't go to Africa. I really wanted to go to Africa, actually. That was the one continent I really wanted to explore. Now, of course, I'm here and at Exeter, I will be teaching marketing and marketing communications, marketing strategy. As usual, I think I hope to introduce some rather unconventional methods. One of the schools that I taught in, we actually founded a student-led agency, and we had a student-led channel as well. So we are hoping, Exeter is also hoping that I will be able to introduce some of those unconventional elements into academics as well. And as you said, I try to bring the world of marketing into the classroom, which is something that I think all business schools should do. We haven't been doing it too well. It's still slightly theoretical, you know, make it more and more hands-on, you know. So I call it something, the marketing agency simulation. That means every classroom is a marketing agent, like the kind you head,
Okay. And it's good to for students to be doing it so early on while they're studying, so that they get a kind of introduction to what life is going to be. So where did it begin for you? Influences and the early influences in terms of how you planned your career, or how did it come about?
Well, marketing was at its infancy, or at least marketing communications to some extent was at its infancy. Everything was growing around us. The multinationals were coming in. So we didn't really know, for instance, that there were ad filmmakers who could make a pretty tidy fortune. So it all happened to some extent by accident. I started out in management, as most of us did, because we didn't know anything else. Then I moved into an advertising agency, Saatchi & Saatchi, where I was again in account management. But at that point in time, what I found really interesting was the creative side. which is where you've been all your life, Venu, and which I really envy. And I remember, you know, spending a lot of the time with the creative guys. And I think I was, irritating them more than anything else. But that was where I really absorbed more about advertising and marketing communications than really in account management. Though the account management guys will kill me for this.
Do you see that as a clear line, or do you see it as a fairly broad set of changes that happen?
I think to most people, it would all seem very abrupt and very quite drastic and dramatic. And to me, it seemed very natural. I was moving within advertising into the more creative areas at that time. My first job was scripting for ad filmmakers. And I think at that point in time, you know, advertising was also growing. Everybody was learning the mechanics of it. And then, of course, there was one ad filmmaker who said, hey, I can't make this particular ad film, but I've told the agency that I know the scriptwriter who wrote the script, so he'll probably do a good job for you. And then the agency took me on. And then, of course, it just kept rolling all
the way. Which was the film?
I think it was for United Breweries Company, because I remember it was something to a lot of drinks and a lot of stuff like that. Yeah.
Right. But writing a film and making a film are two different. So how do you think you manage the transition? You know, because they think that filmmaking is utter chaos and there's a lot of, planning and production, a whole lot of other things which need to be done. And yes, they're happy letting someone else bring a brand film to life. It may be different with feature film producers, but ad films are generally, you know, there's a lot of work involved in, and it is very controlled creativity.
That's a very interesting thought, Venu. I mean, it's made me think about it. And if I had to hazard a guess, I would say a director, especially in ad films, is a script writer with a bit of management skills.
Okay.
That means even the script writer has the ad film in his head. He has it in his head, but he doesn't know how to translate it. That means he doesn't know, oh, I have to brief the cinematographer this way. I have to work with the editor this way. I have to work with the music director. He probably can hear the music in his head, but he doesn't know how to get it out of the music director. So, I mean, I'm just thinking of this as you asked me the question. It's a script writer who has a certain amount of management skills. I know, again, this is a thought that nobody would really come up with. A director is somebody who has management skills, because you're managing very, very talented people who are specialists in their own right. The music director knows more about music than you. The cinematographer knows more about cinematography than you. The editor knows more about editing than you. And yet you have to get your point of view. To a certain extent, you're imposing your point of view on them. So you need a lot of very, very strong people management skills to be able to do that. And I think to some extent, that is where maybe some very highly talented students who, for instance, I've met at FTI, they may have very high creative skills, but maybe they're not able to translate some of those skills onto celluloid.
What was the process like when you were into making or creating marketing communications? Was teaching still, something that got you interested, or was it something that you parked for a little while you concentrated on filming?
I think, I come from a long line of teachers. I think some five generations or something. So maybe there's something, maybe there's some kind of gene floating around somewhere there. But I think I remember the first lecture I did was at one of the IIMs. I then became the first Indian to do lectures at IIM, which is a management institute, at the Film Institute, which is obviously about film, and at the National Institute of Design. So they were quite disparate institutions. It became interesting because I was teaching about marketing and I was teaching about filmmaking to IIM students, to management students, how films can introduce your message, etc., etc. And I was teaching advertising to feature film students.
Okay. That's quite a shift.
I remember, and I remember a very interesting incident. I went to FTI on the invitation of the head of the direction department. They are highly talented individuals, very egocentric as well. You know, probably the best taken from, you know, thousands of students who apply. I think a majority of the students asked me, why should we learn at filmmaking? We are watching one great film every evening. Why should we learn how to make ad films? I said that, look, you're going to enter filmmaking and you're going to struggle. If you look at the statistics, you're going to probably struggle for something like 5 to 10 years. If you can make ad films, you are ensuring that you can make a comfortable living. You're also learning your craft.
Right.
You're learning how to shoot. You're learning how to edit. You're learning how to do music. And you're working with the best professionals with very generous budgets. So you're learning at the expense of, you know, these huge multinationals. It's a second line of income, which you shouldn't discount. The interesting thing is that the Whistling Woods is one of the institutes and Film and Television Institute is the other. And out of all the students, I think quite a few of them finally became ad filmmakers. And they became almost full-time ad filmmakers. And I remember, meeting them recently. And I said, look, this is not what I meant. I meant that you should, you know, do ad films as a way to sustain yourself, not to, you know, get comfortable and, you know, relax and not worry about feature filmmaking at all. So some of them have gone back, but quite a few of them have become full-time ad filmmakers, which I'm not happy to see at all.
But do you think there is a fundamental difference between the way ad films are created? Because there are very few people who have made a transition from ad filmmaking to feature films, because you see a few examples. Yes. But there have also been instances where ad films essentially are about communication, which is cut down to its, you know, a lot of stereotypes are used or archetypes are used. Whereas films allow for development of character, there is a difference in how a scene plays out or how it's conceived. But I think we're going more into a discussion of film rather than...
No, and I think that's a very interesting track, wonderful thought that you've raised. It's true that there are not as many ad filmmakers as one would think who have moved successfully into feature films. One of the reasons, apart from all the creative reasons, apart from the, you know, formats are completely different, etc. I think one difference is also that when you're making an ad film, it probably takes a month, probably, or at the most a couple of months. So you are seeing your end product at the end of a month or 2 months. So you're, apart from, you know, the money or whatever, you the creative satisfaction that you get from seeing your product over is pretty quick. The turnaround time for a feature film is something that a lot of people don't realize how torturous it can be. I mean, the minimum, I would say, is something like 3 years, right? So we're talking about from the germ of an idea into the final day when the film is in the theaters on Friday. It can take a minimum of 3 years. It can take up to 5 years or even longer. So you have the instance of John Matthew, who took, I think, almost 5 years to get his film into the theaters, who was an ad filmmaker. And that could be one of the reasons. I'm not so sure about this, of course, but I'm just hazarding a guess at it. But it's very interesting. Okay. I think the questions that you're posing are really generating a lot of interesting ideas, a lot of interesting thoughts along the way.
You actually found the time to do a PhD as well. When was this?
That was completely accidental. I mean, it was...
Okay.
When I started doing the lectures, there were certain concepts that developed along the way, the concepts like Reality Plus, etc. Then one of the IIM professors said, you know, you should actually be sort of ensuring a kind of copyright on... He was just making a casual conversation. You should make sure that these concepts are yours. So then I said, I had no idea what this was all about and where it would lead. And he said, okay, so why don't... one of the ways you can do that to protect your concepts is to do a PhD on it. Really had no idea that it would be so terrible. But I took those concepts of mine, Reality Plus and, you know, Afghanistan syndrome and all that. And I spoke to a lot of people in industry. For instance, I had a fascinating interview with Narayan Murthy. So he spoke about how these concepts apply even in his area. Infosys, you know, in IT. And of course, I spoke to people like Javed Films, who spoke about Reality Plus in films. And of course, I did speak to marketing people, advertising people as well, how these concepts translate. So the PhD was completely accidental. And for anybody who's contemplating doing a PhD, be warned that it's not an easy journey at all. I think my wife and daughter have just completed it and they've just barely survived.
Okay. So it runs in the family. So the thing is that you had some kind of an idea, but you were willing to experiment with whatever came your way, or was there some kind of a specific direction that you thought you were evolving towards?
There was definitely a direction. For instance, if you see, I think somewhere very, very early on, I had written down, I found it fairly recently. I think to some extent that this comes from a family background. The family is full of crazy idealists. You know, I have a cousin who did his IIT and then did his PhD at Johns Hopkins and then spent nearly 20 to 30 years fighting female feticide in India. So, but he always ensured that he was financially secure. I think so to that extent, we've always made sure that we do very idealistic things. The idealistic thing can be, you know, in different areas, but we always make sure that we are financially secure. So I found a note somewhere where I'd written that once I have this much, it's not literally this much in the bank, but something like that, then I will start experimenting and doing things that I want. And I'll always be grateful to advertising in that sense, Venu. I think advertising provided all of us, I think, a kind of safe avenue, you know, where we could use our talents in ways that we didn't really expect and which actually, you know, also ensured a fairly comfortable life. Right. And then once the financial aspects were out of the way, which is what I tell students as well, that even if you're taking risks, whether it's about making a feature film or whether it's launching a product, etc., there's something called an affordable risk is a part of, you know, entrepreneurship management. There's something called affordable risk. That means most entrepreneurs look as though they're taking huge risks, but they're taking affordable risks. So when Steve Jobs started his company, it looked as though, oh, he was jumping into the unknown. But he had a home. He had parents who were looking after him. He wouldn't have really lost out much. Similarly, if Samsung was to start, say, a random new product, an airline today, they would start it if they know that they can absorb the loss that can come if it collapses. So that's something called an affordable risk. And I think to some extent, I mean, I'm not saying that there are people who take incredibly risky jumps and who win at that. And that's fantastic. But I think if you have families and if you have responsibilities, etc., I think it probably is better to take an affordable risk.
It's a wonderful concept because in terms of risk taking, affordability is not seen as one of the criterion for qualification. Yes. It's normally seen as you take huge risks or you take minimal risks. But when you put it within the context of affordability, you know, one of the things about affordability is age. You can take risks at a certain point in your life because you're young, which may not be possible, you know, let's say later on in life.
Absolutely. And
so do you think that the average, you meet with a lot of students. What has been the kind of change that you have observed over, let's say, generations of students in marketing as to how they approach their career? What are their needs in life? And how do they view the future?
Actually, continuing on the thought of about the risk and, you know, what marketing students today face and, you know, over the earlier generation, I would say this is not something that I would tell every marketing student. But if you see young couples today, generally when young couples get married, you shouldn't be taking too much of a risk because, you know, you're setting up a family, etc. But actually, that's not quite true. Today, generally, both are working, right? So when one person has a pretty secure job with a, you know, fixed income coming in, the other can take a risk. It could be the man, it could be the woman, it could be, you know, either of them, but it's possible for that to happen. And when it comes to other changes, I think one of the wonderful things that is happening today is there's so much structure. There is a syllabus for marketing, there's a syllabus for marketing communications, there's even a syllabus for event management, right? Now, these are industries that, I mean, if you take event management, for instance, which is very much a part of marketing communications, it didn't really exist earlier. The industry didn't exist. So when the industry didn't exist, obviously even the academic aspects of it didn't exist. Then I saw the growth of the event management industry, and today I'm seeing event management is being taught in management schools. It's a proper part of the syllabus, etc.
Correct. Yeah.
So marketing students are learning a lot in the school itself, which is fantastic. Something that's wonderful. Of course, as and Venu, you are really a wonderful example of this. The world of marketing is changing so much. These students have to keep abreast of all the changes that occur almost every day, right? I mean, look at ChatGPT. I'm not quite sure. It's definitely changing academics, because every professor is wondering how, you know, you're going to tell whether a student has done his own work or whether it's work that's come from ChatGPT. Even from the world of marketing, there's such a huge difference. There was this lovely, I think, was it Emirates? There was an Emirates commercial which had a Christmas ad.
Okay.
Showing reindeers pulling their plane, right?
The flight. Absolutely. Yeah, literally the flight takes off with the reindeers. Though Absolutely. That was simply added on later in special. It was a simple idea, but it was beautifully executed.
No, yeah. I was just looking at it and I was thinking, okay, now there are two aspects to it. The idea was brilliant, but if it had been made in the wrong way, it wouldn't have gone viral. And what do I mean by the wrong way? If a professional ad filmmaker had made it in the professional ad filmmaking way, that means there would have been beautiful lighting, there would have been music, there would have been a voiceover, there would have been, it would have been a beautiful commercial, but nobody would have shared it.
Yes.
The charm of the commercial was that it looked like an amateur video, which had been shot from the airport window.
Right.
I think it was, you know, as though somebody had just shot it casually. Because of that, everybody shares it and they say, I'm not sharing a commercial, I'm sharing an interesting video.
Yes. So, in fact, these things are really what have changed, because earlier a company had to pay to get its commercials out there. But the smart ones have found that they can get, you know, practically unlimited exposure, provided the ad, provided they don't retain that huge grip over what the brand should be.
Absolutely.
It won't be entirely to your satisfaction. It won't give you complete control, but that is the whole point, you know. How do you do this? And I think that is one of the things that companies also will have to learn over time. Your brand image is now shaped as much by the consumers who consume it as it is by the custodians of the brand.
Absolutely. And I think, I think young students and people, can really learn from you in this way. No, I think what I've seen is that you grew up in the traditional forms of advertising. You learned your craft there. And then you completely relearned all the rules and you are enjoying it thoroughly. And you're taking full advantage of that. And that's something that I would tell every student of mine to do, because what's going to happen 5 years from now or 10 years from now, things are going to keep changing. And if they don't keep abreast of it, at this point in time, young students may feel that, I'm abreast of everything. I know how this works. I know how that works. But will you know how it works five years from now? Will you know how it works 10 years from now? If you're not going to keep abreast of it, I think marketing is one area where if you don't keep abreast of things, you're just going to get knocked out very, very quickly.
And that has huge implications for a career, right? Because if every subject, if every field is changing fairly quickly, it means that your leeway for making money off a certain skill or knowledge that you have is shrinking. I remember in the early days when you recorded and you wanted a studio and he told you that he bought a piece of equipment and for the next 7-8 years, he could use the same thing.
It is, there is no way that, you know, the same thing will hold true. Though what you're doing doesn't change dramatically. Yes. What you change and how, unless that little touch of the reindeers pulling the flight off the ground is something that people with limited exposure to films could never have done if they didn't have the tools. I'm sure you've seen some of these things where editing is so tight that this guy, he throws himself forward and he suddenly becomes a banana. He's sitting at a table.
Yes.
So when you look at it, you say, how is it done? And this is done with low-tech tools. It's not...
Absolutely.
And I think what you said has amazing significance for how people should plan their careers. That is, long-term is important, but the long-term is a series of short-terms.
Oh, absolutely. That's a very, very, very nice way to put it, Venu. That's really a nice...
What are some of the things, their concerns in the class right now? What are the things that they are worried about? Is it that choice tends to make things even more difficult, or does it make it...
Yeah. Again, fascinating question, Venu. I think, you know, it's definitely true that, you know, our parents had a rough time. You know, you remember the old joke that, you know, they climbed 3 miles uphill to school and they climbed 3 miles uphill to school, back to home as well. And they swam across rivers to go to school. I mean, it may have been, some of it may have been even a reality. And then we had it slightly easier. And today, you know, our children may sometimes go in cars to be dropped at school, etc. But are they under more pressure than us? They are definitely under more pressure. And as you said, I think one of the reasons is definitely because there's too much choice. I mean, and that can sound confusing, but I think there's even a marketing exercise that a company did. They had offered, I think, 12 varieties of jam at a supermarket, and I think the customers were fairly happy. And then I think they expanded it to some crazy figure, like 120 varieties of jam. And actually the customers were not happy. They were getting confused. They felt they were missing out on something by buying one particular brand, etc. So now imagine a student being confronted with such a wide variety of choices all his life, every time. And he's also being exposed to so much. I mean, you are being exposed to the best things in the world. So even if somebody's doing something reasonably well, he's seeing something immediately that's been done by somebody in New York or somebody in Hawaii, and that guy has done it much, much better. So the standards have been raised. The choices are huge. So to some extent, even though, I mean, students may be learning in a comfortable environment in an air-conditioned classroom and all that, and the fees that their parents are paying are very high for MBA classes, but the challenges that they're going to face are going to be really, really tough. Their survival is not in question. You know, they'll always have most of them will have a roof over their heads, food on the table. But beyond that, they will always be worried that, am I missing out on something? You know, that will always be, and that's something that, to some extent, I think that's where India can maybe offer a kind of balance. I think the Western consumerism is something that we have all accepted, which is cool, which is fine, which is something that is required because it makes everybody progress. But to some extent, Indian culture also helps you to stay grounded, that families are important, that being at peace within yourself is important, even using examples like yoga and meditation, et cetera, just to ground yourself in your own personal reality, even as the world is in chaos. You know, the world around you is going to be in chaos.
Right.
There's a lovely Sanskrit sloka. I've forgotten the original Sanskrit, but the thought is that my soul dances on even in the middle of chaos.
Okay.
You know, so to that extent, I think India and Indians and Indian culture, etc. I think Narayan Murthy said that, as a matter of fact, in the interview that, I mean, we had a very wide-ranging conversation. And he said that, see, we Indians tend to change on the surface. When the British came, we wore Western clothes and we spoke English. But we went right home, took off our slippers at the door, changed into our mund and lungi and kurta and, you know, and went to our tables and ate with our hands off stainless steel plates. To some extent, the accepting change, accepting change, and at the same time staying grounded is going to be very, very important for young people, because they're going to see, as the Sanskrit sloka said, there's going to be a world of chaos around you, but your soul should keep dancing on, you know.
It's not easy at all. It's interesting that the person who, you know, was at the head of Disney and then left and now he's come back, Bob Iger, he's come back to head Disney streaming, is very clearly saying that I want to cut down choice. He says, I'd prefer to have a few films or a few serials that people definitely want to watch rather than give them a wealth of brilliant serials and TV on which they have to keep trying to make up their minds. Which, you know, in an era of plenty, invoking scarcity seems the craziest thing of all, and yet it has logic.
It's a wonderful thought again, Venu, and I'm so glad that you've brought it up. I think even if you see, I see comments, you know, on social media that I'm spending, that people are spending so much time on Netflix trying to decide which movie or which series to see. They spend too much time, you know, trying to decide that rather than actually watching it. So I think the Disney philosophy, the Disney strategy, while it may seem very counterintuitive, it's, I think it's a brilliant thought, and I would really like to see it, you know, how it runs.
See forward. How they actually execute on that.
Yes.
I have a comment here, Anand. Take a look. Sajit Kumar has said, how important is the art of storytelling versus the characters in an ad? Have influencers changed the advertising landscape?
Very, very lovely question, Sajit. Actually, if you again, you can see the evolution of characters in advertising. Right. Earlier, whenever we chose, you know, when we did video tests like we did for Venu, etc., when we did video tests for models, we would just take the best looking model and that was it. Then I think the creative directors like Venu and agencies and marketers all realized that no, you don't just need a good looking model, you need somebody who's a character. Maybe she's a cranky wife. Maybe she's a humorous wife. Maybe she's a very strong wife. Maybe she's whatever. Or, you know, so you need a character rather than just a good-looking housewife. So in that sense, the stories, the storytelling itself began to change because we are revolving the story of Surf or whichever product we're talking about around a character. So I would say, obviously, you know, the first, probably the first one to realize that was Surf and Leavers, where they said, you know, you have this very tough, shrewd housewife who calculates everything and then decides that Surf is the right detergent to buy.
Yeah.
You know, she's not a goody-goody, perfect housewife or the best-looking housewife. And she's just quite sharp. She's quite strident. And she won over the hearts of so many people. So that is so to that extent, the introduction of characters has definitely changed the storytelling aspect. And how have influencers changed it? I mean, they've changed it so much. I was looking at something that some influencer had posted about some chair. If an ad filmmaker had shot that commercial, we'd have shot it with perfect lighting, we'd have made it up, we'd have made up her hair, and it would have been a perfect commercial and it wouldn't have worked. This girl just sat on that chair and she made some comment about her boyfriend and all that, said something about the chair. I don't even know how she connected the boyfriend and the chair, but she did it in some weird, you know, very funny way, and it worked. It worked brilliantly. You know, this was in Singapore. And I think influencers work their magic in a very, very subtle, unconventional way. But you, as long as they are believable, the moment they cross that, I mean, obviously, you know that influencers are paid. But the moment it starts looking like a commercial, oh, you know, here I'm holding the pack and, you know, then it's not going to work. The influencer's magic works when it looks as though, you know, she's just sitting before a laptop and saying, oh, you know, this is a great product. And she's doing her usual crazy stuff. And she may not be made up. She may not be even dressed well. She may be just in a very untidy bedroom, but it'll work.
And exactly like you said, army of YouTube influencers who talk about beauty, they themselves may not be conventional beauties by any yardstick. The techniques that they propagate are not by any means what a well-known brand would actually advise. But they have legions of followers and they have a whole lot of people tuning into what they have to say. It has become a career option, which you would never think of, let's say, 10 or 15 years ago. Okay, it extracts a certain toll because it means that you have to keep innovating. The pressure is huge. I don't know if you've heard of this person called Physicswala.
No. Tell me, Venu.
It's almost like the Indian version of what Salman Khan did, the Khan Academy. So there was this guy who started teaching physics on YouTube in Hindi and English with just a blackboard. He's now got huge amounts of financing.
Wonderful.
Wonderful. And he did it almost as a measure of desperation. This is what I can do. I can take a phone. I can put it in front of me. And then he learned. That is the other great aspect, that they don't, when they start, they don't know filmmaking. They don't know pedagogy. They don't know how to get across to students. But what they have is the connect. They seem like one of us. It seems like I can talk to this person, which is why it works. Yeah. These are not career options that one would have even thought of 20 years ago. So YouTube has completely changed yardstick by which careers are formed and changed. So there are people who can have classes on gardening and still make a decent amount of money, which wouldn't have been the case earlier. But we will still have, of course, conventional classrooms and universities and degrees, because there is validation which is required. For a whole lot of jobs, it's as if you can't make a decision without some kind of validation from a source that you trust.
And so, the universities, the way the universities are working, definitely will get disrupted. It's just waiting to happen. To some extent, the pandemic actually helped. In the sense it sort of prodded the universities to move into digital, into the digital realm and into online degrees, etc. And that's going to be really fast-tracked. I remember, I think we discussed once a long time ago about somebody who said that maybe I can learn, I don't need to go to a film school. I can learn filmmaking, watching YouTube videos, etc. And I can also work in a film set. That means, actually work in a film set. So universities have to be competing with that. Now, if universities have to compete with that, they have to change as well. They have to, give parents of students some kind of validation that what we are teaching is going to be more valuable than that. And it's not easy. It's definitely not. It is. The universities are going to be disrupted. At some point, I think Amazons of the world will, I think, start universities of their own, and they will be creating universities which cater to the needs of the employers directly. I mean, so you'll have multinationals who own universities, and those universities will be very geared to jobs. So that will happen. Of course, there is so much scope for other kinds of learning as well. In the sense, when you're learning literature, or when you're learning the classics, or when you're learning sociology, or when you're learning, you know, all those wonderful areas would remain somewhat untouched. But these are all guesses that one is hazarding. Universities are also places where change is a little more difficult, not because universities are orthodox and they don't want change, but because parents are conservative when it comes to their children. Now, every parent wants to ensure the best possible education for their child. And so when they are making decisions for their child, it is unlikely that a parent will say, hey, go out there and work and learn from YouTube videos rather than go for a degree. Some time period where universities will be able to continue without having too much drastic change, but that change will slowly happen. in the workplace as well. To some extent, it's parents who are very conservative.
And physical jobs, what used to be considered blue collar. I was reading the other day that Walmart, for example, pays its drivers somewhere in the region of $75,000 to $90,000 per year to start off with. And that starts off with a four-week course. So if they spend 10 years, if they've got 10 years experience, they obviously make probably as much as a graduate who's gone to a big university. So do you think those opposing forces of physical comfort on the job is something that's going to define how careers evolve?
I saw that happening in Singapore. Because in the early days in Singapore, I mean, to some extent, all Asians tend to want their children to have degrees, postgraduate degrees, work in an office, etc. To some extent, there was a certain hesitation for parents to want blue-collar jobs for their children. So you could see that Singapore is very tightly run by the government itself.
Right.
So initially, the Singapore government was very comfortable with that. And they were encouraging parents and encouraging students in that direction. But now they're going the other way. They are realizing that, oh, there will be students who will be happier, number one, in blue-collar jobs. Number two, they will be better paid at blue-collar jobs than at some of the white-collar jobs. And so that's something that, you know, as I said, the Singapore government tends to shape the thinking of its citizens. So they are now trying to, you know, inculcate respect for blue-collar jobs among in Singaporeans, which is something that I think to some extent in Asian societies, India, China, Singapore, the blue-collar jobs tend to get neglected because parents don't want their children going in that direction. But they are very highly paid. A security guard at Cambridge makes as much as a lecturer, you know. So, it's quite ironic that poor lecturer has spent all his life doing his PhD.
Which brings up the other question. You know, what is satisfaction in a job? Is it the money or is it the intellectual curiosity? Some people are just not, you know, they're happy doing the same thing over and over again. So how does one figure out if one likes a routine and not straying from it too much? You know, it need not be that every person has to figure out the next wave of where the world will go or to change the world, as you know, most companies today would like to believe. But they're satisfied with their lot and can make a very comfortable living, which used to be that of the factory worker during a certain period.
Yep. I remember there was this student who was working, I mean, after finishing his MBA, he was working at Nielsen. And everybody was very thrilled because that was a very plum job. And, you know, his parents were happy, his teachers were happy, his classmates were proud of him. And then I remember him bringing me and saying, you know, I want to intern with in ad filmmaking. And I said, you have this lovely steady job where, you know where your next meal is coming from. And, you know, you're venturing into something that's a little more uncertain. And he said, no, you know, I really enjoyed the creative aspects of, you know, when we were doing our MBA. And this is something I'm just not enjoying it. He was reasonably good at it. That's why he got the job. But he left it. And I remember being a little apprehensive at that point in time, because not everybody can make it as an ad filmmaker. Yeah. But today he's doing well. He's happy. It will have to, I guess, you know, depend on each person. I think each person is a life and a career in itself. And of course, education and universities and MBA programs like ours as well, to some extent, will straitjacket you. We'll say, these are the careers, these are what's available. This is probably what's best for you in terms of security, in terms of, you know, immediate financial gains, etc. But I think everybody has to look deep within themselves and then decide that, okay. And I said, there is something called an affordable risk.
Yes.
You should take risk when it's affordable, when it's, I think.
Okay. So here's another question.
Hi, Deepa. How or what inspired your management concepts? Any advice to management rookies on how to What inspired the management concepts was definitely my years in advertising, in ad filmmaking. I remember, for instance, companies telling me, it was the chairman of a company, of a very big multinational company, which was making this hair color. And I remember calling it a hair dye in those days, kept calling it a hair dye. And he said, you know, I just want to correct you. We don't make hair dye, we make hair color. And I said, it's just the difference of one word, isn't it? Why does it matter so much? He said that the change of that one word from hair dye to hair color has meant millions of dollars in sales. And that's when I came up with the idea of Reality Plus. That means your reality of the hair color, the product is the same. The packaging is the same. Everything is the same. But instead of calling it hair dye, you're now calling it hair color. So that is Reality Plus. And that is how the concept of Reality Plus came. And which, and I also remember that one of our, multinational client came to us and said that, you know, he was making this milk, you know, this powders which you add to milk drinks, you know. And he said, our powder is genuinely very nutritious. It is the best in the market. And he was saying, I'm not plugging my own product. I know that if you take it chemically, it is the best product in the market. But how do I convince consumers about that? So in his case, it was almost like reality minus. That means the reality of his product, that it was far better than all the other products in the market. But you know, the other products were doing, you know, better marketing, et cetera, et cetera. So the marketing concepts come from actually practicing what you see out there in the marketplace. Wow. It's really fascinating how...
You went to Tashkent and taught there for some time. You've taught in so many... the book you've written, The Peddler of Soaps, which became a bestseller. I don't think we've touched upon... Because we, I think we went deep into a few aspects of, you know, what careers are today, what jobs are today. And I think it's fascinating how, you know, your combination of academics and practical experience in marketing has shaped so much of your thought and helped you to bridge something which was essentially not... you know, it's almost as if these were silos earlier. People from academics would rarely come into contact with people who were in the industry. And to industries, academics were people who only theorized. So I think you've kind of set out a path which says that the lines that divide careers are going to be even less, you know, defined as we go forward. Because people are getting to be filmmakers and influencers and writers and photographers because that's how the new world is like.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You can't stop at one. So is there something that you'd like to leave us with? Is there something that you would like to tell young people who are on the, you know, the early part of their career?
I think we are living in the... Absolutely. We are living in the most exciting... in the most wonderful phase of human history ever. It's not something just that I'm saying that is optimistic, etc. This is based on fact. There's a whole book written by somebody from Harvard, you know, by Professor Steven Pinker, who said that this is really the best phase of human history in terms of poverty becoming less, in terms of democracy, the growth of democracy, in terms of equality, in terms of women's equality, in terms of every aspect of life. Now, all these wonderful aspects of life also translate into, this is the best place to do business. This is the best place to do, to start your own company. This is the best time to make money as well. To some extent, there are even, I know it doesn't sound very, because we are always listening to bad news, but there are even less wars today because people have begun to realize that you can actually trade with somebody who's alive. You can't trade with somebody whom you've killed. And that's a very harsh truth, but it's a commercial truth. So Steven Pinker's book is wonderful. It means that we are living genuinely in a wonderful world. We're living in a world that is at its best ever, and which also means that this is a great time to be working. This is a great time to do business. This is a great time to start your own business, to make money as well as to enjoy your work.
Thank you. It's been wonderful having you on the show, Anand. Thank you
wonderful
for taking the time.
Just and talking I think to you is an education by itself.
My First Job, the podcast, is a production from Ideascape Communications. Guest relations, promotions, and creative is managed by Deepa Ravi with occasional support by Venugopal Nair. Archiving and technical help is provided by LPS Jayachandran.